This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, in anticipation of the conventions, we're looking back in time and featuring interviews about presidential history and politics. We expect newly elected presidents to assemble cabinets that reflect the president's positions. Abraham Lincoln took a different approach. He brought into his cabinet three powerful men who had politically opposed him. How and why he did it is the subject of the book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, by the Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She writes, "In my own effort to illuminate the character and career of Abraham Lincoln, I have coupled the account of his life with the stories of the remarkable men who were his rivals for the 1860 Republican presidential nomination: New York Senator William H. Seward, Ohio Governor Salmon P. Chase, and Missouri's distinguished elder statesman Edward Bates." Lincoln appointed Seward Secretary of State, Chase Secretary of the Treasury, and Bates Attorney General. I spoke with Doris Kearns Goodwin about Lincoln in 2005. Your book is called Team of Rivals, and it focuses on cabinet members who were his rivals, who actually wanted the nomination for president from the Republican Party. Why would he choose his rivals to be in his cabinet?
I mean, it seemed at the time an unprecedented act because people hadn't done that in previous years. And these men were not only his rivals, but they were so much better known than he was. Seward had been the governor and senator from New York. He was so much considered the possibility of being the person who would win the nomination that 10,000 people were waiting outside his home in Auburn to celebrate. The champagne had already been stocked in the local restaurants. And he thought when he was made Secretary of State that he would actually run the show and Lincoln would be just simply some sort of puppet. But in fact, Seward and he ended up becoming great friends. I think Lincoln had an internal confidence that even though these men thought they should have been president, similarly Chase of Ohio thought he should have been president, Bates of Missouri, an elder statesman, Stanton, who eventually becomes Secretary of War, had humiliated Lincoln once when they were young lawyers together. But he was able to put those past rivalries beside him, knowing that if these guys do a good job, then it will only be down to the interest of the country and obviously to his own interest as well. And it meant that he had to have, much more than they realized, a sense, I think I can handle these guys. I can master them. And
what,
he did.
What do you think Lincoln did to bring together this cabinet of rivals?
Well, what he had going for him, which I think is so unusual in political life, is that he had a set of emotional strengths that today we might call emotional intelligence. So when all sorts of rivalries sprung up with these guys, and when they got hurt with one another, when they would call each other names, I mean, if we ever heard what they were calling each other then in today's parlance, liar, traitor, thief, I mean, and these things are being said in cabinet meetings, but he was somehow able to be in the center of that storm. When one of their feelings would be hurt, he'd be able to write a letter saying, if I hurt you in any way, I did not mean to do so. Forgive me for things that I might do hastily. When he was upset with somebody, he would write what he called a hot letter, where he would write it all down, and then he would put it aside until his emotions cooled down, and then write, never sent, never signed. And there was a sense about him where he was just kind and sensitive to them. If one of them was feeling he was spending too much time with another one, he would call that one aside and give him a special time to walk together or to go on a carriage ride together. So what he essentially did is what a great politician does, which is to understand that human relationships are at the core of political success. And he somehow managed these people who, as I say, oftentimes hated one another, wouldn't even go into the same room with each other after a while. Stanton and Blair, his postmaster general and his secretary of war, said such terrible things about each other that Blair would never even go to the War Department, even though he wanted to find out what was going on in the battles. It's almost unimaginable that he was able to keep this group together, but the success in keeping it together meant they also represented very different spectrums of political opinion, from very conservative to moderate to radical. And as long as he could keep that coalition together by keeping these people inside the tent, he was actually keeping those strands in the country together as well.
What was considered radical then?
Well, what was considered radical then was the idea that early on you wanted to make emancipation the central focus of the war. And then later on, even after emancipation was made the focus, the radicals were more desiring to make the South pay for having gotten us into this war in their judgment, and to wreak vengeance on them in order to be able to make sure that the old social structure would not come back in the South, whereas the conservatives were thinking that the Union was more important than emancipation. And also at the end of the war, they wanted to make sure that the South came back in a more gentle way so that the Union would be preserved, even if it meant not punishing the leaders of the South who had been part of the Confederate cause.
And where did Lincoln stand?
Well, Lincoln stood in the middle on all these things. I mean, naturally in the middle, not because he was positioning himself in the middle. At the start of the war, he thought that the Union was the most important thing, and that emancipation, he wasn't sure, was something that he as president could do anything about, much as he might have wanted to, because it was in the Constitution protected. So he thought the most important thing was to get a constitutional amendment to eradicate it, which he eventually did. But by the middle of the war, he came to understand that as president, he would have powers as commander-in-chief when a military necessity was at issue to be able to do something about the slaves. And the slaves were being used to help the South. They were digging the trenches. They were acting as cooks. They were protecting the home front when those soldiers went off to war. And they just unbalanced, gave so much benefit to the Confederacy as opposed to the North, that he finally was able to decide legalistically that if he issued a cry for the emancipation as a military necessity, he would have that power to do it. Eventually, you'd need a constitutional amendment. So he moved toward what might have been the radical side. On the issue of Reconstruction, I think even by the time of his death, however, he did not want to have vengeance against the South. But he would have been worried about protecting the rights of blacks, which they were also worried about. So he probably would have been in the middle on that ground as well.
What did he do to hold together this group of people within the cabinet who had such differing views about what the fate of the South should be and what emancipation should look like?
Well, I think partly what he did was to move step by step toward emancipation. You know, just as Franklin Roosevelt moved step by step toward getting us more involved in World War II, even before Pearl Harbor, by Lend-Lease, by the peacetime draft, Lincoln began to move toward certain steps that would allow the Army, for example, if slaves came into the Army camp, to take them into the camp and keep them protected from the Southern slave owners. And these steps allowed him to move some of the conservative members to see, well, we did that, and it didn't produce some sort of race war, because the conservatives were always afraid if you emancipated, there'd be this incredible servile war in the South, so that it got them accustomed to the idea. And finally, however, the interesting thing is when he finally made the decision to emancipate the slaves, he called his cabinet together, and he told them, I want to tell you what I've decided, and I will listen to your comments, but I want you to know I've made this decision. I think he finally knew that if he put it up to a vote or a discussion, then it might make it harder for these people to understand that this was his decision. And the only thing he did was he accepted their thoughts on the style of it. He accepted Seward's advice that he not issue it. He was going to issue it in the summer of 1862, and the war was going very badly for the North. And Seward said he thought it would look like he was just desperate and that it wasn't an act of considered opinion. Why not wait for a victory to issue it? And Lincoln took that into consideration, agreed with Seward, and waited until the Battle of Antietam was fought and successfully resolved before he finally said he was going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. So I guess in some ways what it meant was he listened to them as he was going along, but he finally had to decide for himself what he was going to do and then just tell the cabinet in a very forceful way, this is what I'm going to do. I'd like you to think about it, but it's my decision.
What happened to these cabinet members that you write about, the team of rivals, after Lincoln was assassinated?
Oh, it's so interesting what happens to them. I mean, first of all, Chase is one of the more interesting pieces of the story. He was one of the few cabinet members who never did accept Lincoln's primacy. So even in 1863 and 1864, he was plotting to run against Lincoln for that second nomination so that he could beat Lincoln and become the president. Lincoln knew everything he was doing. He was aware. Lincoln had incredible tentacles, so he knew what was going on. But he somehow kept him inside the tent rather than letting him go outside. And then finally Chase did resign from the office of Secretary of Treasury. He had embarrassed himself in many ways so much because it became known what he was doing against Lincoln. But then in the fall of 1864, after Lincoln had won the election, he appointed Chase to the vacancy that arose in the Supreme Court when the Chief Justice died, giving him the highest position on the Supreme Court, even though he said, I'd rather swallow a chair than do this to Chase, who he didn't like. But he knew that Chase, who was an abolitionist, would be the best protector for the rights of the newly freed slaves.
Well, William Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, wasn't he shot during the assassination?
I hadn't fully realized what happened to William Seward. During the assassination attempt, John Wilkes Booth really had a triple assassination in mind. He wanted to get Seward, the Secretary of State. He wanted to get Andrew Johnson, the Vice President, and, of course, Lincoln. So he took Lincoln on for himself. The person who was supposed to kill Andrew Johnson chickened out and didn't go to Johnson's hotel. But the man who was assigned to Seward went to Seward's house at Lafayette Park, and he managed to get inside. Seward had had a carriage accident about a week and a half before, and his jaw had been broken. He was up in a bed, so he pretended he was bringing medicine up to Seward. But Seward's son understood that something was wrong as he barreled up the stairs and tried to stop him. He then took the blunt end of a revolver and hit Seward's son, who was his assistant secretary of state, on the head so badly that he was in a coma for days. He then took out a knife and slashed two or three other people, came into the room, slashed Seward's entire cheek off, and just happened to miss the artery that would have killed him. And he then ran out and slashed another couple people on the way out. So it was one of these extraordinary moments in Seward's family life. And however, he somehow managed to pull through. And in fact, his son also came out of the coma and pulled through. And the incredibly sad thing was that his wife, Frances Seward, who was torn apart by the thought that she was losing her son and her husband, was so tense. And she wrote an article in which she said, "I've never before believed in vicarious suffering, but I think somehow that my son and my husband are getting well, and I've taken their suffering onto myself." And in May, only a month or so later, she died, and no one knew quite what she had died from, and she was not an old woman. So that the Seward family was forever broken by that event. But the part I think that got to me the most emotionally was that they didn't want to tell Seward that Lincoln had been killed, knowing how close friends they were. So they kept the news from him, but finally he looked out the window and he saw the flag at half-mast, and he turned around. He said, "I know Lincoln is dead." They tried to say, no, that's not true. He said, "I know he's dead. If he were alive, he would have been the first one here to see me after my knife attack." And then great tears coursed down his cheeks, and he knew then his chief was dead.
A recent book about Lincoln says that he was gay or bisexual. I haven't actually read the book, so I confess. So I'm not sure which it asserts, but have you reached any conclusions about the president's sexual orientation?
Well, one of the great things about the comparative perspective is when you see something like somebody claiming that Lincoln was gay, you can look at what the evidence is and look at it in relationship to all these other guys as well. For example, it is said that because he slept in a bed with his best friend Joshua Speed for 3 years, that that's one indicator of the possibility that he was gay. They also point to letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, which were quite affectionate and full of a feeling, of intense feeling. But if those are the measures, then almost all my guys, as I sometimes call these cabinet members, would be looked at as being gay, because it was very common for men to sleep in beds together. In fact, when Lincoln was on the circuit in Illinois, they would all travel around the state together, the judge and the bailiffs and the criminals sometimes and the lawyers, and they'd stay in the same boarding houses where there weren't enough beds. So sometimes two or three lawyers would be in a bed together. The only one who got his own bed was the judge because he weighed over 300 pounds, so no one could be there with him. And then when I looked at the affectionate letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, his friend, they were nowhere near the intensity of some of the other letters that I found. For example, when two of his cabinet members, Chase and Stanton, were young men in their 30s, they had both lost their wives and were very lonely and became very close friends. And I found these letters that Stanton wrote to Chase at the time saying, "Since our pleasant intercourse last summer, no one has been on my mind more waking and sleeping. I dream of you at night. I can't wait to sit by the fire and hold your hand and tell you I love you." Similarly, Seward, when he was in the state senate in New York, formed a friendship with another senator who wrote to him saying, "I have positively womanish feelings for you. I miss you when you're not here. This is not the right thing for a grave senator to be talking about. I do not think any charges were ever made or any thoughts that these other men were gay." And I think that just means that men were more free in that age to express their deep feelings for one another. There was very little friendship between men and women because women were so chaperoned, so that women and women formed very close friendship. Men and men formed close friendships. And I think it was just an age where I wish almost we had it today, where men could really express those feelings as openly as they could then. But I don't think that we can imply from that sexual contact or sexual intimacy was the end result of those letters or the sleeping in the same bed.
Now that we know so much more about depression than we used to, historians are starting to examine how, you know, depression may have affected important figures, including Lincoln. Do you have any new thoughts about what you describe as, melancholy temperament and how that affected him as a leader?
I came away feeling that rather than suffering from chronic depression, that Lincoln did have a melancholy temperament from the time he was born. There's a writer named Jerry Kagan who studied children from the ages of 0 to 20 and argues if you look at them even 3 months, 6 months old, you can divide them into whether or not they have a melancholy or a sanguine kind of optimistic temperament. And clearly, I think Lincoln had that melancholy temperament. But he also had enormous resources all the way along to figure out how to get himself out of his sad moods, humor being one of them, conversation. During the Civil War, he would go to the play when he wanted to. He went to the theater 100 times during the Civil War, if not more. He would go to the battlefront when he felt sad over the loss of a battle to talk to the soldiers. He had an acute awareness, I think, of his own needs. And except for two depressions, which we know about, one when his first love, Anne Rutledge, died, which it's natural for somebody to fall into a depression, and secondly, there were a series of events that took place when he was in his 30s. His best friend, Joshua Speed, was leaving town. His political career had suffered a blow, and he had broken his engagement to Mary Todd Lincoln. And he really did feel overwhelmed then by depression. And we have letters that he wrote saying that he was the most miserable man on earth, and that if everybody felt like he did, there would not be one cheerful face on earth. And he actually was so frightening to his friends that they removed all razors and scissors from his room, fearing that he might take his life. But his best friend, Joshua Speed, came to his side and said, "Lincoln, if you do not rally, you will die." And he said, "I would just as soon die now, but I haven't done anything yet to be remembered by." He had this dream from the time he was young that he was so fearful of just dying and turning to dust that somehow if he could accomplish something great, this is the way the Greeks used to think, your name would be remembered after you die. And that powered him through the early losses of his childhood. It powered him through his early days in the state legislature, and it helped get him out of this depression. And the great thing is that many years later, when he finally signed the Emancipation Proclamation, Joshua Speed came to see him, and he said, "Well, Speed, remember that conversation we had when I was in my depths? Well, maybe at last my fondest wish has been realized. I will be remembered after I die."
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you very much for talking with us.
You are so welcome. It's a great pleasure to talk to you again.
Doris Kearns Goodwin recorded in 2005 after the publication of her book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. By the way, on tomorrow's show, when we continue our series of interviews about presidential history and politics, we'll hear from former press secretaries representing each president from Reagan through George W. Bush. And we'll talk about some of the tough spots they were in, like this confrontation between Helen Thomas and Scott McClellan in an October 2005 White House briefing.
President Meade, what do you mean by total victory? That we will never leave Iraq until we have total victory. What does that mean?
Free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East, because a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions.
If they ask us to leave, then we'll leave.
Okay, I'm trying to respond. Well, a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the broader Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions of Al-Qaeda and their terrorist associates. They want to establish or impose their rule over the broader Middle East. We saw that in the Zawahiri letter that was released earlier this week by the intelligence community. Well, Helen, the president recognizes that we are engaged in a global war on terrorism. And when you're engaged in a war, it's not always pleasant, and it's certainly a last resort. But when you engage in a war, you take the fight to the enemy. You go on the offense, and that's exactly what we are doing. We are fighting them there so that we don't have to fight them here. September 11th taught us.
It had nothing to do with Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah, well, you have a very different view of the war on terrorism, and I'm sure you're opposed to the broader war on terrorism. The president recognizes this requires a comprehensive strategy, and that this is a broad war, that it is not a law enforcement matter.
Sorry, on what basis do you say Helen is opposed to the broader war on terrorism?
Well, she certainly expressed her concerns about Afghanistan and Iraq and going into those two countries. I think I can go back and pull up her comments over the course of the past couple of years.
And speak for her, which is odd.
I said, no, I said she may be, because certainly if you look at her comments over the course of the past couple of years, she has expressed her concerns. She has expressed her concerns.
Scott McClellan, and he's one of the presidential press secretaries we'll hear from tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.